Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Illustration Department Podcast. My name is Giuseppe Castellano. In this podcast, I talk to folks in illustration, graphic design, publishing, animation, and other creative fields about their beginnings, their successes, and the bumps and bruises they've experienced along the way. In this episode, my guest is Caldecott-winning artist and writer Uri Shulevitz. There are a lot of illustrators out there who want to write but don't because they think they're, quote, not a writer. Well, who better to talk to about that than the author of the beloved book, Writing with Pictures? Among other topics, Uri and I talk about how he went from fleeing the Nazis in 1939 to publishing his first picture book in 1963. He explains why he thought his career in children's books was over before it really began, and Uri tells us why illustrators should give up on the idea of the perfect picture. I hope you enjoy our conversation. I'd like to start in 1939. The Germans invade Poland. They bomb your hometown of Warsaw. You and your mother fled to Russia, I understand, on the back of a smuggler's truck to meet up with your father.
Right.
You were four.
Yes.
What do you recall from that moment when your mother decided we have to get out of here?
The reason we left is because father was already in what was now Russia.
Right.
Actually, Bialystok used to be a Polish city, but after the Molotov-Ribbentrop agreement of non-aggression between the Soviet Union and Nazi Germany, Poland was divided between Germany and Russia. And that's how Bialystok became Russian. Mm-hmm. So father was already in Russia, and we went to join him.
Gotcha. Between the ages of 4 and 14, you and your parents moved from Poland to Belarus to northern Russia to Kazakhstan, back to Belarus and Poland, then Germany, France, and finally Israel, looking for refuge, you know, and looking for the place to sort of set down some roots. You said that art and stories were your lifeline. How so?
Well, for example, During our stay in Turkestan, most of the time, actually, we were starving. And especially, this is something which is very difficult for a growing kid. And when I say starving, I don't mean that we were missing certain things. I mean total starvation, when there were days and days when actually there was no food whatsoever, nothing. Mm-hmm. And I went to bed night after night on an empty stomach. And what sustained me at that time was the stories that my mother used to tell me. Mm-hmm. So I developed a great love for stories. Stories became very important to me. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that sustained me was my love of drawing. I've been drawing basically since I could hold a pencil. And so that goes back, you know, sure, way before when I was 4 years old. Mm-hmm. And that's really what I kept doing. So I have drawn, and whereas other kids draw as well, but the difference was that they stopped at some point and I never did.
Yeah. You said that even before I saw myself as an artist, I do think I had an artist's intuition. What does it mean to have an artist's intuition? And the reason I ask that is because I am an artist, and there are a lot of artists listening to this, and I worry that maybe I don't have it.
I'm sure you have it.
You never know.
Wait, could you be more specific? Where did I say, in what context?
It was in the context of this interview you had given way back. And the context essentially was, you know, the person was asking you about your childhood and how you got into art. Essentially, your answer was that even before you got into art, you felt that you had what you had said, what you had called an artist's intuition.
For one thing was, it seemed like the main love And my total being was really, I I had to draw. And I kept drawing. And perhaps what I meant at the time was really imagination, where I could visualize scenes. For example, in my book Chance, I mentioned about having a very vivid imagination. And what I meant by that was that, and I said that it was a curse and a blessing at the same time. And actually, one of the interviewers had asked me, what did you mean by, why was it a curse and a blessing? Well, it was a blessing in the sense that I could visualize scenes which were vital for me as a, when it came to illustrating a situation in a book. Mm-hmm. That I could see it in as if it were real.
Right.
And what I meant by a curse was, on the other hand, I can also visualize nightmares that were scary and painful as well. And but basically what it was is, it was, I'm at a loss for words to actually be able to describe it. It was a drive in order to keep drawing.
Right. Okay. I think that means I still have the artist's intuition. Or at least I'm going to go ahead and believe that I do.
I'm sure you do. I wasn't talking about anything that was sort of extraterrestrial or something. Everybody.
Why did you decide to move to New York City in 1959?
I wanted to. You see, when I was in Israel, Israel at the time was still a very new country, mm-hmm. and when it came to art. The museum in Tel Aviv, we didn't live in Tel Aviv, actually, but we were sort of what could be called now a sort of the suburbs of Tel Aviv. And when I would come to the city, there was a little museum, an art museum. And the kind of art that the museum had to offer was very, very basic and I was very hungry to see art, mm-hmm. and the only way that I was able to, I was buying magazines, art magazines that came from France, for example.
Right.
And my access was only to reproductions, mm-hmm. and I was very, very much hungry to see original art, and then. Came up the I had no plans to come to America initially because America seemed to be something like only in the movies or in something that was unreal and imaginary and wonderful and so on. Mm-hmm. But then my cousins who lived in New York invited me to come and I could go to study art. So I came to New York and I studied art at the Brooklyn Museum Art School. That school no longer exists, but at the time, actually, it was an important art school. Mm-hmm. And, people like Beckmans taught there, and I think also Rufino Tamayo. So that's why I came. And then I was able to go to the museums. To both the Museum of Modern Art and to the Met, mm-hmm. and also to the other smaller museums like the Frick, mm-hmm. and this was something which was extremely important to me, and this was really one of the reasons that I wanted to come here.
Wait, you didn't? How long did you plan? Like, what was the initial plan? Just a brief visit.
The initial plan was really to stay for a couple of years to study and then go back.
What made you stay?
I won't go into because that kind of has to do more with life than with anything that has to do with art.
Okay.
And I fell in love. I got married, etc.
Gotcha. The reason I ask that is because my parents came here as immigrants in the 1960s, so about 10 years after you came here. And the initial plan was they would both come here, work in factories, they would make money, and then after a couple of years, go back to Italy with this, you know, lots of money that they would be earning in America. And so when I was two, we all, the whole family moved back to Italy. Well, we didn't move back. We went back for the sole purpose of my father looking to buy a place to start a business, and we were going to settle in. And long story short, the real estate agent was late to show my father this business that he was going to buy or rent. And my father just was impatient and just, you know, just basically was like, you know what? Screw this. We're going back to the United States. And we went back to the United States. So had that real estate agent not been late, there's a very high possibility that our family would have stayed in Italy.
Yeah, well, this is interesting that you tell me. And by the way, what part of Italy was that?
They're both from a small town called Casamassima, which is about half an hour south of Bari in the region of Puglia. So the heel of the boot.
Oh, I see. Okay. You said Bari, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, right. It's supposed to be actually a fascinating area because I have a cousin who lives in Genoa, and she told me that, you know, I mean, I love Italy. I mean, it's seeing the art, especially the one in Siena, made a great impression on me.
Right.
And also when in Venice, I got to see Tintoretto and the late work of Titian. It was, you know, frankly, when I sat there with an open mouth and I thought, after this, there is no point in painting.
Because, oh, man, I feel like that every time I look at any piece of art.
I you know, speaking of that, I want to make it clear that actually I am a painter who illustrates, mm-hmm. because my first vocation was not to be an illustrator, but rather to be a painter.
Yeah.
And I was lucky enough that I was able to illustrate so that, because I wouldn't have been able to live. You know, by selling a painting once in a, you know, once in 10 years or something.
So, are you a Mannerist fan, like Pontormo, Tintoretto?
Tintoretto, I loved what I saw. You know, especially there was a painting there, I think it was the abduction of Saint Mark, mm-hmm. which kind of really blew my mind.
Yeah.
There was also another, you know, at the Rocco Foundation, you know, the life of Jesus. And in the very last room, there is a huge painting of the crucifixion. And that one was just incredible.
Yeah.
The ones you mentioned, Pontormo and some of the others, I neither was familiar nor particularly interested in them.
Okay.
And at the time, I don't think I felt affinity with the Mannerists.
Gotcha.
Besides, I didn't even know about them.
Right.
And it's only in much later that I became acquainted with them. But I never thought of Tintoretto as being a Mannerist, although you are no doubt correct, you know, about that.
Yeah.
But they also, I mean, Titian certainly was no Mannerist. Yeah. And there was a painting when he was old at the Accademia in Venice. I think it was a Pietà, and it was so loosely painted, you know, it was just like...
Well, yeah, I mean, that's
very
kind of
modern.
That's kind of why I ask, because they are, when you look up close to those paintings, they are very aggressive and very loose and not at all polished like, you know, a century prior to them. And your work is very loose and gestural and expressive, and I don't know, I thought there was a little bit of connection there, but anyway...
Yeah, well, I always felt that my work wasn't loose enough, and I was actually aiming at loosening it up, and I don't know whether I will have the opportunity to do that, but anyway, I felt that I've been too shy, you know.
Too shy to go looser?
Yeah.
I did read that you said tightness comes from anxiety. When illustrators get tight with their work, it's because they're anxious about it.
Did I say that?
You did.
Well, you know, I can't remember everything I said, but I suppose it's correct.
Yeah. I wanted to just go back. So we're in Italy. Let's fly over back to New York. And a few years after moving to New York City, 1962, if we want to be exact, Susan Hirschman at Harper & Row saw your portfolio and suggested that you write children's books. Your response was basically like, well, I'm not a writer. I'm an artist. I'm an illustrator.
Yeah, well, the way it went, what happened was as follows. I mean, at the time, actually, she was still Susan Carr. Mm-hmm. And I didn't feel that I could, I needed very badly to make some money. And I'm not talking about a lot of money, but just a matter of survival. Mm-hmm. And I have done a lot of drawings, that were kind of, illustrations.
Sure.
For little things. Mm-hmm. And I felt that at the time Harper and Row was doing the most interesting work.
That's true.
And I got in touch with the publisher, and they were very receptive to new people. And so anyway, so I saw Susan Carr because Ursula Nordstrom, the head of the department, was at the time in Europe accepting a Christian Andersen Award for Minder de Jong, one of their authors. Mm-hmm. And so that's how I got to see Susan Carr. I showed her my attempt at illustration, and that's when she said, why don't you write your own story? And I thought that was it. My career as in children's book was over. And I said to her, I can't write. And she said, why don't you try? Well, I couldn't argue with that. And so I went, I went home and I tried to write something, and I brought it back to her, and I showed it to her, and she said, it's too slight. At the time, I didn't quite understand what was really meant by too slight. Mm-hmm. And I kept going back home and trying again, and back and forth. And that was a kind of my training in a way. Sure. And finally I came up with my first book, The Moon in My Room.
Yep.
And finally she was pleased with it.
Wow.
By that time, Ursula Nordstrom had come back from Europe. And so actually now I was working with Ursula.
Yeah.
I did my 6 subsequent books with Harper and Row.
Yeah. The Moon in My Room was published in 1963. Ursula Nordstrom published in 1963 another book that people might recognize called Where the Wild Things Are.
At that time, I had already met Maurice. His book actually came out before mine, maybe a year or two before.
Really?
And originally what it was called was Where the Wild Horses Are.
Yep.
Well, what he told me was, and he showed me also some sketches, and I was so impressed. He lived at the time in the village.
Mm-hmm.
And I was so impressed that he did so many studies, and I thought things should be coming easier. And so I learned my lesson that actually, to really, he was a very hard worker. And that kind of was another lesson for me.
Mm-hmm. 6 years later, 1969, you won a Caldecott Medal for The Fool of the World and The Flying Ship. I assume they called you Do you remember what you were doing when you found out that you had won the Caldecott Medal?
Yeah, I think it was in the morning, and I'd gotten up. No, actually, you know, I used to work late into the night, so that morning I happened to have been up early, and so they called me. But I already had a warning from my editor to expect something. So it was very exciting.
Sure.
But I heard talk that my prior book, One Monday Morning, was considered for the Caldecott, and for some reason didn't get it. So they felt guilty, maybe, and I got it for the Fool of the World. I don't know, but the way these things work is a
sure.
little mysterious.
Oh yeah, still
and,
is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But what was interesting in connection with this story, when One Monday Morning came out, what was his name? He was at the time the dean of Frisbee, Fritz Eichenberg, mm-hmm. had written a review of the book in the New York Herald Tribune. A wonderful review in which he called it that someday the book may become a classic. And to my great luck, this was the weekend when it was supposed to come out. That was the last time that the New York Tribune was being published. They had gone; they were going out of business. Yeah. So that actually it never came out. Luckily, I was able to find a copy of their book review in which the article was.
Right.
So anyway, so sometimes these things happen in such a way you can never expect.
Right. We could talk through the 60s, 70s. There's a lot to talk about, but in the interest of time, I wanted to skip to 1985. When I talk to illustrators about their careers, the idea of, quote, writing, I don't know why I'm quoting that, but the idea of writing typically comes up. Often they say, well, I'm not a writer, I'm an illustrator. And I find that a bit odd. I mean, what are you doing with your illustration if you're not telling stories or conveying information or interpreting an observation? Illustrators are writing. Pardon my phrasing here, they are writing with pictures. So it's always odd to me when an illustrator says to me, well, I'm not a writer. You actually just might be. What led you to writing with pictures?
My struggles when I was beginning. There were so many problems I had to face. For example, my first book, The Moon in My Room. Mm-hmm. I had to, I mean, in those days, I mean, now it's only history. But in those days, we had to pre-separate. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you were using color, it wasn't something that was easy. Because if you had four colors, you had to make four pieces of art for every single picture.
In black,
and you just marked, you know, the color on the page, but they all resembled one another in the sense that it was black. So when it came to my first book, I was really in the dark, and I wasn't happy with the results of the printing because I had no guide. How am I supposed to do it? But that wasn't the only problem. I mean, you know, there were other issues that I had to deal with. But, you know, on the subject of the, you know, of that first book, when we went on press and I was able to go on press as well, mm-hmm. Together with the art director, mm-hmm. Dorothy Hagen. And I mentioned something to the printer, so he said, kids wouldn't know the difference. When I told that to Dorothy, she said, "We'll never use that printer again."
Good.
And you encountered all kinds of things like that. Mm-hmm. And then I discovered, those squares of color, different combinations.
Swatches?
No, not swatches. It will come back to me, but I can't think of it right now. And I actually, because in the beginning, what we were doing flat colors. Mm-hmm. And once I had discovered the color combinations, I developed actually a means by which I could do half tones. Mm-hmm. And which I later taught my students. And not only that, but my editor asked me to teach Bill Steig how to do pre-separation.
What?
And I must say, yeah. Well, he was such a talented guy. Anyway, we were living one street apart in the village. So I went over and I showed him how to do it. He was amazed by those squares of color. And I had made little holes in them, cut out little windows. Mm-hmm. He was very impressed by that. But anyway, he picked it up right away. And then when he used it in his book, I think it was called Amos and Boris, about a little mouse and the whale. He had used it very successfully.
Yeah.
Wow. So that was about that. But there were other problems. I mean, problems simply in terms of writing stories. Of course, I mean, those illustrators who are saying, "I'm not the writer," that you were very wisely commenting on, they could have done picture books without using any words and only using pictures. And what I felt, and I wrote about it in writing pictures, mm-hmm. was the difficulty, which I discovered in my problems with writing, was that I was confusing the what with the how. In other words, I was mixing up, what I was going to say with how I am going to say. And that was a big revelation and something that helped me greatly, mm-hmm. that, to tell the story with the simplest words, and then one can think about how to say it better. Mm-hmm. Because of all the struggles with all the different things that I encountered while I was doing my own work, my own books, I decided I'm going to do something for other people, and because I wish that I had such a book.
Sure.
And the only book that was then was by Henry Pitts, and that wasn't satisfactory.
Right.
So that's when I decided I was going to write that book.
Yeah.
And I was warned by some people in the know, "Uri, don't do it. Just keep doing your own books."
Why?
Well, I was crazy enough to do it, and it took 10 years out of my life to actually do it.
Why were they warning you against doing it?
Well, because it was a terribly big project.
Sure.
And I didn't realize it at the time. If I had known that it's going to take me 10 years to write it, I probably wouldn't have done it. But I did it, and once I started, I had to keep going. And so I did it for the next generation.
Yeah, and the next one, and the next one, and the next one. In doing research for this chat, I learned that writing with pictures was rejected before it found a home with Watson Guptill. What were people saying with their rejections, if anything?
Well, I tried to go to my publisher for astrology.
Yeah.
And they said, "Well, I'm sorry, but we don't do books like that. We don't do how-to books."
Okay.
And then I went to other publishers. I went to Harcourt Brace. Mm-hmm. And they were willing to do it, but if they would make a deal with me that they're going to do the book if I'm going to commit myself to do picture books for them. and I refused.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a great deal of difficulty actually getting the book published until my friend James Cray, a wonderful designer who was working at the time with Watson Yacht, said, "Why don't you try them?"
Yeah.
And so they finally published it.
And James designed the cover, didn't he?
James actually designed the entire book.
He designed the whole book.
I mean, wow. And he did it fast. It was amazing. I mean, he really was professional and wonderful.
Right.
We were friends.
Yeah.
But and he did it because he knew, somebody else was going to do how much headache it's going to be.
That's
so
true.
He actually went ahead and did it did a terrific job.
This episode is sponsored by Skillshare. Skillshare is offering listeners of the Illustration Department podcast a free trial of premium membership. If you're going to take just one online class, let it be with the ID. If you're going to take two online classes, take one with Skillshare. They offer fascinating classes on topics including productivity, freelancing and entrepreneurship, creative writing, and much more. Many of you know that I hate the word perfect. It is a word that does not serve us as artists. Let's all agree to replace perfect with progress. So, practice makes progress. Whatever goal you have in mind, advancing toward it is achievable with short lessons, hands-on projects, and classes you can fit within your schedule. Explore your creativity at Skillshare.com/ID, where you will get a free trial of premium membership. That's 2 weeks free at Skillshare.com/ID. Now back to my conversation with Uri Shulevitz. You know, I have a copy, and it's from 1985. It's not a first edition, sadly, but it's like an 11th edition or something. It's definitely a reprint. One thing that jumped out at me, and it was both a happy feeling and a sad one, was that you wrote about Sendak and Steig and Lobel and Margaret McElderry and Margot Zamok and other greats in the present tense. You tell us how Arnold Lobel doesn't like making a tight book dummy for fear of losing vitality when he proceeds to art. You also tell us how he, storyboards his books, but it's all in the present tense. And I thought, it was both a sort of a really pleasant observation, but also a bit of a sad one.
Well, I knew all of them, and we were friends. I wouldn't describe it as hanging around them. Each one was a different history.
Sure.
Maurice, for example, what happened was there used to be exhibitions at the Eagle Gallery, which, have you heard of that?
I have not, no.
The Eagle Gallery was a gallery that was actually... there was an Eagle printing house in New York City, and there were exhibitions once a year by the I forget the name. There was a graphic artist, and there were once a year those exhibitions there, way before the Society of Illustrators took over and have the exhibitions now. If they still do, I don't know. Maurice came over to me while I was there at the opening,
mm-hmm.
and he introduced himself. I already knew of his work, and I admired it.
Mm-hmm.
He asked me to illustrate a book of his brother, Jack. Because he explained to me, he said, "I would like Jack to, up to now, all the books that Jack had written, Maurice had illustrated them." And he wanted Jack to kind of be on his own, so he thought that would be a good idea to have somebody else illustrate it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was still a beginner, and I was very honored. And so I was friendly with Maurice. I mean, actually, as a matter of fact, one time he invited me for dinner with his family in Brooklyn. And I met all of them. In other words, beside the parents, I also Jack and his sister.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, as far as Arnold Lobel was, we had worked for a gentleman, where Arnold had worked there before me.
Mm-hmm.
And while I was working for this gentleman, I happened to have seen an FNG of a picture book called A Zoo for Mr. Master. And it was, I think, the first book that Arnold did. And that was actually the very first, I was 24 years old, and that was the first time that I saw a picture book. And that's when I fell in love with picture books, because I felt that they combined two of my loves, storytelling and pictures.
Right.
And that was a revelation for me.
Yeah.
So I was friendly with these people, and I belonged very much to that generation, and Ezra Keats and Margaret Zimak, whom I met only once, and to my great sorrow, I mean, you know, she passed away before we could. But it was right away a kind of very simpatico.
Yeah.
Experience.
Sure. I mean, going back to William Steig and Marie Sendak both praised Margot's artwork. You know, I think Sendak said something, I'm not going to get it word for word correctly, but he said something to the effect that her work, she was quite literally changing or elevating the game for children's book illustration. And William Steig called her the consummate illustrator. You know, you hear about William Steig, you hear about Marie Sendak, but you don't hear a whole lot about Margot Zimak. Anyway,
yeah,
I think it's important for an illustrator to shift their mindset from this has to be perfect, this has to be a portfolio piece, you know, to this is a chance for me to explore subject matter that matters to me, to make good decisions with my lines and shapes and color. You said, and I promise that you said this, or at least you were quoted as saying, give up the idea of the perfect, flawless picture and aim for one that is alive instead. What does alive mean in that context? Why would an illustrator, quote, give up on making a perfect, flawless picture?
Well, you know, yeah, I did say that. sometimes, you know, I've been misquoted inaccurately as well.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a very important subject, and I'm going to switch it slightly.
Okay.
I've been asked by students, because I did also teach for many years,
mm-hmm.
How do you know when a picture is finished? What do you think?
That's interesting. I asked Victor Juhas, another illustrator who is a visual reporter, that question in an episode just a few episodes ago. And I think I agreed with him in that you just change that even a little bit. You change your wording. It's never finished. You just leave it. Once you feel like you've solved the problem or conveyed the information or conveyed the emotion, once you feel like you've reached that point, you leave it alone and you move on to the next thing. So it's a trick question. I don't think illustrations are ever, quote, finished. Is that the right answer?
Oh, it wasn't a quiz, you know, to find out whether it was the right answer. If that is your answer, it's right.
Okay.
My answer is different.
Oh, okay.
My answer is different. I think that the picture is finished. And I'll tell you what I believe, and this may sound a little mysterious. I think it is finished when it begins to sing. I said sing.
Mm-hmm.
S-I-N-G.
Mm-hmm.
The big thing is to be able to detect when that happens.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you go beyond that, it's overdone.
Right.
Think of making an omelet. At some point, you know, I'm using the analogy of an omelet because it's so sensitive. To make a perfect omelet is not easy, because if you don't catch it right at the moment, it is overdone. Mm-hmm. And I think that the art is really to develop the ear that you begin to actually be able to hear when a picture starts to sing. And if you don't stop it at that moment, it's overdone. And so I don't believe that a picture is never finished. Hmm. And that is also when it's alive.
Okay.
Do you see what I'm trying to say?
Definitely.
And does that make sense to you?
To me, it does. And maybe it takes practice. Maybe they don't see it right away. But no, I can definitely see it that way. Sure. Right. And I'm not just saying that because you're Uri Shulevitz.
You know, and I'm saying it from experience. You know, I didn't make that up. It's something which actually I've seen again and again. I mean, one can overdo a picture. And this is also that is also to answer your question about what do I mean about the picture being alive.
Right.
There is a point where it's, you know, and many times it's really at the beginning. I've seen so many times when I watch somebody making a painting or a drawing or whatever. And it was alive, and they killed it.
Yeah.
By overdoing it.
Yeah.
By trying for something different. By trying something that is what you refer to, I think, as perfect.
Right. Yeah.
There is no such thing as perfect.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much for saying that out loud. I say that all the time, man, and just to hear you say it makes it all the more. Well, it makes me all the more convinced that it's right.
You were right.
Just to hear Uri Shulevitz say that I'm right is you're kind of blowing my mind a little bit here. But
you're giving you more credit than I deserve.
I don't think I am. I wanted to touch on color, and then I have a fun question, and then one last question.
Sure.
Again, I'm going to sort of take words that are attributed to you and ask you about them. There can be a use of color, of many colors, that will give a feeling of black and white. And there can be a use of black and white that has a feeling of color. You said that in 1986.
Yeah, okay, I can explain.
When does color feel like grayscale? When does grayscale feel like color?
Okay. You can make a black and white illustration that would look colorful. The way to explain that is, I guess the easiest way to explain that is about how rich the grays are. In other words, what are the values?
Right.
Do you see what I mean?
Definitely.
I mean, you know, you can squeeze your eyes and look at a picture. And if you find that all the values are of equal weight, then it's going to look more like black and white.
Right.
But if there is a richness of various values, mm-hmm. then it's going to have more of a feeling of color.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't start to see colors until you're able to differentiate, for example, take different blacks. No black is purely black.
Mm-hmm.
You have to see whether a certain black has red in it or blue. Do you see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
In other words, you take any color, and there is another color within that color. And if you're able to start seeing the color that is within the color, whether, say, a red has blue in it or it has yellow in it,
mm-hmm.
then you actually are beginning to see colors.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see what I mean?
The reason, again, The reason I ask about that is because I do talk to a lot of illustrators and value usage, value hierarchy, value blocking is a very common topic of discussion. And I I'm with you on this. If you get your drawing right, which is the foundation of everything, and you get your values right, that's not the right word. If you get your drawing, if you make good decisions with your drawing, with your design, and if you make good decisions with your values, the color is, I mean, you can pretty much make anything any color, and it'll still look great because the values are there, the design is there, most of the work is already done.
Right.
One fun question and then one last one. Yoga. I read that yoga is listed as one of your hobbies. Is that still the case?
No, Tai Chi is.
How often do you practice?
I try to do it every day, but I don't always, you know, but I certainly do it several times a week. I've been practicing yoga for many years now. At some point, I even taught for a short time. And
what?
I used to do yoga, but for some reason, I haven't done the past years. But Tai Chi, I still do.
Well, Uri, I do yoga every day except for the weekends. I don't even know what a follow up is to this. But the reason I ask is because I do yoga 5 days a week, and it's kind of neat. To have read that, so
yeah. Well, that's wonderful. I hope you, when do you do the headstand?
That is where I'm currently blocked. I cannot at all do the headstand, or I can't do. What's the pose where you put your knees on the backs of your elbows and lift your legs up? Whatever that pose is called, I can't do that one.
Oh, I see. I didn't do that. But I can give you some advice about the headstand.
Oh, please.
I was very lucky. I had a wonderful master. I mean, a true great yogi master from India. And when you practice your headstand, don't do it by the wall. From the beginning, you should do it. I mean, you know, and also any pose that you do in yoga, when your feet are above your head, you should always keep your eyes closed.
Okay.
And this is something which I've seen not every teacher of yoga has been telling the students. But luckily, my teacher was a grandmaster, you know, that told us about that. It took me a very long time to learn how to do the headstand, and I can't explain. You put your hands as a kind of base in a triangle, in a triangular shape.
Right.
And at first, you just try to lift your legs up. If you do that, actually, you already get all the advantages of the headstand. And only gradually, you know, and be very patient. And only gradually, first, you know, don't go any farther than simply putting your legs up.
Okay.
And if you can have that position, you know, that's fine. And gradually, you will be able to lift your legs up all the way straight. And once you do that, then you'll be able to do certain exercises with the legs by twisting your body and so on and so forth. But be very patient and, don't push it.
Well, I've been doing yoga this way for 3 years, pretty much 5 days a week for 3 years. And
right.
I barely can stand on one foot without wobbling. I just don't have good balance. I don't know why. I really try hard to do, one legged poses and stuff, but I really struggle with that too. So I can't, I can barely stand on one leg, let alone do a handstand.
Right. Well, just be patient and do things, progress very slowly. I think that's,
I will. And one day I will do a handstand, and when I do, I will be sure to email you.
Thank you. Now, I hope that this interview was helpful to you. And
definitely, I have one last question. This is the last bit.
Yeah, sure.
It's always good to remember that there are illustrators listening to this episode. Speaking directly to them, especially illustrators who have said to themselves or out loud, I'm not a writer, I'm an illustrator. But to every illustrator, what would be your last bit of advice?
The inspiration has to come from them. If they don't love what they are doing, if their heart is not in it, then there is nothing that I can give them. I mean, this is something which, you know, it has to be an overwhelming desire to do it and to be willing to struggle in order to achieve it. And that is something which kind of will come from their deepest insight. And it is not something that comes from without, but it comes from within.
To learn more about Uri, visit urishulevitz.com. If you enjoyed our conversation, please share it with your friends, subscribe to the podcast, and provide a positive rating and review. Become a patron by visiting patreon.com/illustrationdept. In return, you'll receive our soft enamel pin, a reusable discount code for 10% off, and access to patron-only episodes we're calling Extra Credit. This podcast is produced by the Illustration Department, a global leader in online education for illustrators. Visit us at illustrationdept.com for class offerings, testimonials, the alumni showcase, the podcast show notes, our forum, the bookshop, and more. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time.